This interview is being conducted with Reuben Breitling on August 11th, 2005 for the Montana State University Billings Oral History Project. My name is Shannon Shingleton. I will be conducting the interview. Reuben, you are aware that this recording, that this conversation will be recorded, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Basically, what I'm going to ask you is a few questions on your life before the war.
Okay.
During the war, a little bit after the war, what you did during the war, stuff like that. So my first question is, what was your life like before the war, Reuben?
Well, just an average life, you know. I went up to the ninth grade in school, and then the rest of the time I was working around Sydney, different parts. So before the war, I worked mostly on a ranch and stuff like that, and then I worked for the, there was a culvert plant in Sydney at the time, and I worked for them, and up to the time I got drafted. In 1941, I
guess. Okay.
Yeah,
41.
Well, 42 when
42.
I got
there. Yeah. Okay. And what was your family's livelihood? You said your dad was
a carpenter, in his later years, you know, as a carpenter on Sydney. Prior to that, he was a cowboy on the rancher.
Right.
Yeah. But then when we moved to Sydney, then most of the time he just spent, well, he worked on the ranch in out of Fairview, just west of Fairview there for a while. Then they spent most of the time years in carpenter work and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did your mom hold down any jobs?
No, she just
stayed home.
She was busy with the rest of the kids.
10 of them, yes.
Yeah.
Did you work, well, you said you were working odd jobs around town, the culvert?
Yeah, culvert plant. We manufactured culverts, metal culverts.
Oh, the ones that go under the road
and stuff like that. Yeah, or in road crossing ditches or driveways and stuff like that. Yeah.
How much did that pay?
Oh my gosh! Let's see. I don't think they paid by the hour. I think couldn't have been much more. Maybe about $1 a day, something like that, back in them days. Can you imagine that?
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
They didn't have...
I worked for a sheep herder out west of Sydney by the name of Starr. And he had four bands of sheep out there. And with me and a buddy of mine by the name of Willie Marco, we went out there. We were supposed to deliver supplies like... feed for each one of the guys that was, they had their camps out there, the herders, you know, the wagons, stuff where they lived in, we'd deliver food for them. But once every week we'd go make that round, you know. It'd take us about a day and a half to make the round, and then we'd go back in and we'd work on the ranch a little bit, and then we'd go, we worked there for about 6 months, and we got $30 to, a dollar a day, we worked for about $30 a month. Or if it was 31 days, we got $31 a month.
And this was all on horseback, correct?
Well, horses and buggy and
buggy.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. At that point in time, you were single, of course.
I was single, yeah.
When did you get married?
In 1941.
So it was before you went in?
Early 1941. We just weren't married not quite a year before I got drafted.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What did your wife think of that?
Not very much. she stayed right with me the whole way. Yeah.
Good. And you told me prior that you had one child and then you adopted him.
Yeah.
Did you adopt him prior to going into the war?
No, after I got back out of service and adopted him, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she couldn't have any children.
That's rough. Sorry to hear that. Understanding that you're growing up in Montana, Wyoming, Wyoming. Did you have any political leanings before the war?
No.
Did you were you aware of what was happening at the time?
About the war and stuff?
Right.
Oh, yeah, you bet I knew. Well, the reason I started out being a paratrooper, me and my father-in-law went to the movie. They showed an invasion of Africa, see?
Mm-hmm.
And They showed them guys coming on the beaches, you know, and how they got shot down, you know, just like ducks. And then they showed the training of the paratroopers and stuff like that. And I told them then, I said, if I ever get drafted, I'll go into the paratroopers.
Very smart. What, you know, how did your family feel, I guess, about the war at the time?
Well, my dad was a little concerned about that because he had several boys, you know, mm-hmm. but only three of us, the ones who got drafted, went in the service. My brother Clarence was older. He was drafted first, you know. He fought over there during Africa and then mm-hmm. into Italy before he got wounded. But then I was drafted next. Then my younger brother Elmer, he was drafted after that. And I don't know how he felt then. Of course, I was gone then over there.
Right.
Job, so.
Right.
But yeah. I imagine they were pretty well concerned. My mother kind of took it a little harder. You know.
Right, right. Moms generally do.
Right.
What was your greatest daily concerns prior to the war?
My concern? Well, I was a little upset when I heard about the Japanese bombing in Pearl Harbor and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Yeah. And when it happened, I told my wife then, I was just... You understand that I'll be probably going to war when this is over with. So she kind of accepted the fact and stuff like that, that something like that's going to happen.
Right, right.
And other than that, I figured I was going to go in the service one way or the other. It'll end up in there, I figured out.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, I understand you'd only been married for a year prior
not,
to
not quite a year.
Not quite a year. Did you, I mean, you stated that you figured you'd probably be going in.
Yeah.
What kind of feelings did you have about that? I mean...
Well, be honest with you, I didn't think too much of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I just figured, well, war is war. I didn't have really too much a concept of what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, stuff
right.
like that, you know. But I knew, well, after I got... If I got drafted, then what outfit I'll be ending up in, that's just my determination.
Very good. Was there anyone in your family or community who was a veteran of World War One?
No.
No.
Well, if
no.
there were, I didn't know about them, the older ones. But as far as I know, there wasn't any of them that went in service. My dad wasn't because he was married. He was too young, actually. Well, let's see now. That was in 16 or 17, was it?
I think so. I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not real familiar with World War One myself.
Yeah, yeah. He was married then because some of the girls and kids, they were all born in 1900, 1910.
1905.
Yeah, so he had quite a few children, so he didn't get okay. in that.
And then all your siblings were too young to...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned that your mother moved over here from Germany.
Yeah.
You know, understanding that the Germans were... the ones that you were going to
yeah,
to
yeah.
war with, how exactly did your mother react? I mean, as far as...
She never made a remark about it.
She never made a remark.
That I remember, not to me or anything mm-hmm. like that, you know. And, of course, she was German, so she talked German stuff, but she could talk stuff, so did my dad.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But she never mentioned a bit of it. My dad either, you know. He just figured they were the enemy now, just
right.
what he could see.
Right. Did your family suffer any, I guess, persecution for your mother being German?
Mm-mm.
No.
Okay.
What were your perceptions of the war and its combatants prior to the U.S. entry? Basically, what'd you think about what was going on and why?
Well, my conception that over Europe, I didn't think too much about it because I didn't think that bothered us as our concerns,
right.
you know.
Right.
But after the Japanese bombed us, I figured, boy, they're getting too close to the United States.
Right.
Yeah. So
okay.
then I was concerned about it. I was ready to go in and fight. That's what I told my wife. I said, if I don't get drafted pretty quick, I said, I'll volunteer.
Very good.
<Yeah.
laughs> Very good. Where were you, prior to U.S. involvement in World War II, There was a huge movement for isolationism. Basically, us to keep our nose out of everybody's affairs, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. How did you feel about that? Did you feel that that was a proper stance?
Well, I felt like we shouldn't get involved over in Europe, you know, because right. that was being concerned. But when the Japanese bombed the Pearl Harbor, then I figured, well, we should get in the battle. We should.
They pretty much drug us into it.
Well, where I looked at, that was the United States they bombed, you know.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Where were you getting your information at the time? What was your main source?
Radio. And news in the paper, and theater showed a lot of that, you know, right. in the theater, yeah.
Very good. Where were you, and what were you doing when Pearl Harbor got attacked?
My wife and I were in a movie, and when we come out, we heard about it, yeah. That's when it happened. I can remember that day.
Do you remember the name of the movie?
No.
What was your initial response to it? I mean, you've talked a little bit about it already, but...
Well, yeah, and I told her, I said, what I was telling you about it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I bet you we're going to go into service, you know, pretty yeah. quick, you know, because I had a buddy, well, I heard that they do, and then they had word out that National Guards and all that is going to be in the military. My buddy, he was in the National Guards, so how come he got going? Of course, he went to South Pacific, and that's where he got killed over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two cousins that got killed over there. And so,
understandable.
Yeah.
What was your family's response to Pearl Harbor getting attacked?
Well, Their response is just, you wonder what in the world is happening. This world, you know, why is it happening? And I couldn't make any answers. I didn't know. I mm-hmm. had any idea what was going on. But they were really concerned about it. They were upset. Well, my one brother was married, and he had two kids, and he said, well, I suppose I'll be going in to fight him. But he ended up, he didn't have to go. So.
As you know, Jeanette Rankin was the only person to vote against going into World War II. Do you remember Jeanette Rankin, the first woman senator? Congresswoman? No, what was she? I can't remember. Well, she was the only one that when the vote went up in front of Congress to whether yeah. they were going to go to war or not, she was yeah. the only one that voted no. How did you feel about that?
I don't know if I heard too much about it, you know. I didn't
right.
know too much about it at the time, who voted, who didn't vote, you know. Actually, I wasn't too much in that politics at then.
Understandable.
Yeah.
And then you...
Who was the woman that voted against?
Jeanette Rankin.
Oh, yeah.
She was from here in Montana.
Yeah.
Of course, you said you were drafted.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned earlier that if you wouldn't have been drafted, you would have probably enlisted.
Yes.
Very good. You chose the branch of the Army, namely because you...
Well, I didn't choose the branch of Army.
Oh,
well,
they
drafted me, and they didn't... Well, when we're doing through basic training, then the Navy come in there and they talk to us, and the Air Force talk to us, and the Marines talk to us, and of course I had my mind made up that it's going to be the paratrooper. But I had a buddy that was with me, Alec Bott, and he wanted to be in the Air Force. He wanted to be a tail gunner and a bomber. That was his idea. But while we was taking our basic training, so one day he says, there was an airfield pretty close to Macon, Georgia there, so I said, let's go over there and take a look at it. He tried to talk me into going to film. So we went over there and we told them what was going on. They treated us like kings right away when they found that was interesting. So they asked, you see, want to take a look at that certain bomber, I can't remember, B-something.
B-52?
Yeah, that big one, you know.
Okay.
That, yeah. And then he says, he want to look at it. So he said, and I looked at that and I asked him, he was a captain, was showing us around. I said, where's that tail gunner? He said, you see that thing way down in the end of the tail there? You had a crawl clear back there on your belly. And you laid on your belly and you're firing that machine gun back there. And I told him, I says, where's the parachute in case something happens? He says, there ain't room for a parachute back there. And I told him, I didn't say any more after that, you know. Then when we got all done, we left there, and I told Alec, I says, what in the world possessed you to go back in that little hole? I said, if you want to be a gunner, why don't you take the Turk gunner or the belly gunner or something like that? He said, I don't think I even want to be a gunner anymore. So he went in the paratroopers with me after basic training.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the third jump, and he broke both legs.
Oh.
Yeah, then he was out. But he stayed in the paratroopers, and he became a medic.
Very good.
Of course, I can finish the story later on until we get to that point where you want to, where the rest of it happened.
Okay. Let's see here. We're moving quite along. You stated how many of your family was drafted?
Three of them. Yeah.
Okay. And then do you know how many from your particular community?
Pardon?
Do you know how many from your particular community there in Sydney were drafted?
Well, not for sure, but I know the group that went with me, I think there was eight of us who went over to Ute, Montana to take the physical and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You said your mom took it kind of hard that
she didn't say too much, but she wouldn't talk about it too much. It just kind of bothered her pretty bad.
How did your dad feel about you guys going?
Well, he didn't. He figured that we should go and do our job. But he's one of them guys, anybody that attacked the United States, he was upset.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Where did you do your basic training at, initial basic training?
Camp Wheeler, Georgia.
And how long was it?
13 weeks.
13 weeks. Had you ever been to Georgia before?
Nope. And I'll tell you one thing about Georgia. I used to work here in Sydney and stuff. I worked in the wintertime, I never wore underwear underneath my shirt. Just with a shirt and a jacket on.
Mm-hmm.
I got the basic Camp Wheeler, Georgia there, went out there and training, getting towards the fall of the year, and I like to froze to death there. Because the humid weather,
Very much.
I wore an undershirt and a heavy coat on. I'm still cold.
And how long was your initial basic training?
In
Fort Wheeler.
Fort Wheeler? 13 weeks.
13 weeks.
Yeah.
And then you went on to Fort Bragg.
Then I went to Fort Bragg.
Yeah. For jump school.
Not Fort Bragg. Fort Benning.
Fort Benning.
Benning,
Fort
Georgia. And that's where we went parachute training,
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they had them big mock-up towers and all that stuff where we learn how to jump and all
right.
that stuff. And the basic training on the paratroopers, the first two weeks was basically exercise and how to jump out of a plane and how to roll when you hit the ground and all that. And they take us up the tower, way up about 250 feet up in the air, and then they turned it loose and the chute would open up and we'd come down real fast, and then I learned how to land and stuff. And then they taught us how to fold a parachute after we collapse a parachute after we jumped to hit the ground. And they had a big 8-foot fan stuck off that in the back of us, and they had the parachute laying on the ground and stuff, and we was laying down there. And when that fan took over, and they'd lift the parachute up. So the wind had hit it, and then it'd go, and then we had to collapse it before it pulled us all over the country. And different things like that. All about jumping and everything.
Was basic training and your advanced individual training there at Fort Benning, was that what you expected?
I didn't have too much of an idea what it was all involved as far as mm-hmm. the training was concerned until I got there. Yeah, it was a strenuous hit. I mean, they really worked. Push-up seemed to be the biggest deal, Then we had to climb rope. I mean, you just climbed, it didn't teach your feet anything. You get a hold of this rope, you're about 100 feet up in the air, and you climb that up and then come back up. And we've done that, every day there for about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Twice we've done it every day. And then push-ups and exercise and run 10 miles every day.
Yeah. So did you feel that you were we'll talk more about when you actually get over to Germany, but did you feel that basic training physically prepared you for everything that
That's
was to come?
That's what the idea was, the trainers, Because when before I went in service, I'd done a lot of running. You know, when I was going to school and stuff like that, I was in the track quite a bit. And I took one year I took the North Asian Park Championship in track racing, 100-yard dash and stuff like that.
Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah. Pretty good. So as far as running was concerned, even when I was a kid, my brother and I, we lived about 4 miles out of town. We'd run from home clear into Sydney, then back again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, was that the first time that you had spent any significant amount of time away from home?
No. When I was 16 years old, me and a buddy of mine, we hooked a freight train in Sydney, and we went from there down to Billings. We waited there overnight. It was late, so we stopped overnight. We was in this freight yard there, and that's the year Joe Louis became championship of the United States. I think in 1936, something there. And while I was in there listening to it, the guy sitting there had a radio, and said, when it's all over with, he got up and he said, okay, you line up, and he's a railroad bull. And he made us empty your pocket, and what money he had in, he took it for freight and freight. Most of my money, I had $3.50, and I had it in my boot. It's in underneath my foot. And he didn't get that. The rest of them he got. So we walked out the edge of the yard there. He told us to get out of the yard. So we walked the edge, and the train is heading for Wyoming. So we hopped it then and went into Wyoming.
Oh,
I was gone about 3 months, and then I come back home. That's as far as I've been away from home.
How did your family react to you leaving?
The rest of them didn't say. My dad, when I got home, all my dad said to me, he says, well, did you get it out of your system?
What a great dad.
Yeah.
Well, when you were in Georgia, you know, going through basic training, how did you feel about being away from home at that point in time?
The first couple of weeks or so, it kind of bothered me stuff. But then you got going in that, and you became friends and stuff like that, different guys. And it, of course, I thought about it a lot, but it didn't bother me that much, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things, I guess. I
understand that. Yeah. How much contact did you have with your wife?
I'd write her about, maybe twice a week or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But after I got over the service, sometimes it's lucky she got a letter from him in a month because so much. After we had started in combat, then the writing didn't come so often.
Can't shoot right at the same time.
Yeah.
Now, understanding that this, of course, gearing up to go to war, I'm sure they wanted to keep you current on events that were happening in the Pacific and European theater. How were you kept informed of these events?
What was going on in the combat areas?
Right.
Well, they had their, usually there was a guy that talked to us about it, and they'd tell us about different stories, you know, some officer in there, how they got the reports and stuff, I don't know, but they're not mentioned by radio and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even contact with headquarters from over there.
Okay. What do you remember most about basic training, Reuben?
Well, basic training in Georgia was that it was kind of miserable, and that's where I lived. Well, I was fairly good with rifle. I'd done a lot of hunting when I was a kid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I got the M1. Well, when I trained in Macon, our weapon was the old Enfield,
mm-hmm.
the bolt action Enfield. You know, that was what we was using to shoot. But it was good shooting. I'm pretty accurate. But can you imagine going to combat with we got pretty good, you know. Most of the training we was doing there was with Enfield, and then also with a 45 Colt. Mm-hmm. They had a revolver and then a pistol, you know.
Right.
We fire both of them. Yeah.
Is that what you liked the most about it? Was the
well, my favorite weapon was, after I was in there, when I became a bazooka gunner, I was carrying a Thompson machine gun,
mm-hmm.
and boy, I loved that thing. that thing could really throw people down.
Now, coming from Montana, you know, going to Georgia and meeting people from all over the United States. What kind of experience was that?
That was the weirdest doggone thing that ever happened to me. I didn't realize there was some really different kind of people, and they talk different and stuff like that. You know, God, oh, Friday. I was wondering what the hell kind of world I got into.
Understandable. Let's see here. What did you do? Well, you said you did a lot of running while you were in basic. Yeah. What did you do when you did have downtime? What kind of recreational stuff did you guys do in basic?
I'll tell you the truth. In Camp Wheeler, when they took the basic training there, we'd done a lot of, not as much running, but we did a lot of bivouac areas, you know, take us out in the campus. And it seemed like I thought the southern part of Georgia is just nothing but swamp. And every time we went out on basic training, we had to go through water. And I think they picked them on purpose. when they didn't have any training to do, I more or less went through the library and just read and stuff like that. But I didn't even go to town. One time I went to town for about 2 hours, and then I come back. Other than that, I never did go back to town.
So. Understandable. Yeah. When you were meeting all these people from around the country, you know, understanding they had different mindsets, attitudes, did it create any kind of tension as far as, you know, your relations with them?
No, it's not that, you know. Most of them guys, you know, they're about halfway happy, you know, and everything, telling stories and stuff. And some of them act kind of odd, but then, they probably thought I was odd, you know, when I got in there. Excuse me. I come from Montana. And when I told him that I was from Montana, and that one kid says, "Oh, the Indians still fight you over there?" I said, "Oh, yes." I said, "I carry a rifle with me all the time." I said, "You have to shoot 2-3 of them a day." And they believe that stuff.
That's good. Did it change any of your previous perceptions of how, I mean, you said that you thought they were a little weird sometimes.
Yes.
I guess going into it, did you have any set idea of what these people would be like? And if so, once you met them, did it?
Well, after the time the 13 weeks were over there, you know, you become friends, you get accustomed to them and stuff,
right.
And it's just natural then, you know. But when I went to the paratrooper training, you know, there was only two of us at that group that went over there that I know went to the paratrooper. The rest were just, I guess, sent out to different things. Mm-hmm. See, well, by the end of that basic training, there was the Marines there, and there was the Air Force there, and some of the guys went in the Air Force to train, and them guys signed up for the Marines and the Navy, and
right.
But then you had to sign up for them, like in paratroopers, you had to volunteer. They wouldn't say you have to go to paratrooper or anything.
Right.
You had to volunteer for it,
right.
Just like you would in the Marines or any of them other ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I asked you this physically, but how well do you feel basic training prepared you for combat, as far as mentally, physically?
I mean, I learned a lot in basic training, both in the regular basic training and the paratrooper training.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if it hadn't been for that, I'd have probably been in a lot of trouble, you know. Yeah. They really taught you a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Do you remember your
and you learned how to take orders and discipline. That was a great thing about discipline and stuff like that, you know. Well, they had to, you know. You can't go in there. And I did it a couple of times myself. I didn't have much use for the second lieutenant. I called them 90-day wonders. We'll go into that later after we're over in France and what happened, and I'll tell you the story there.
And then, other than the running and the shooting and whatnot, what other kind of training did you have while you were in basic, as far as...
They had a nice library there, and they had a canteen in there, you know,
mm-hmm.
and stuff. You can go in there and read, and you can play pool, and they had a tennis court, and then that little bench, you hit that little ball across the...
Ping pong?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And all that stuff. They had a lot of entertainment there. They had a thick theater there. You could go to the theaters and stuff. And, the only theater I went in one of them once and then some opera singer there. Boy, I couldn't take that. I couldn't stand that. I had to walk out.
Understandable. Now, as you were getting towards the end of your jump school training, and realizing that you know, you were that much closer to going to combat.
Yeah.
What were your feelings and your expectations of what was to come?
Well, I didn't pay too much attention to that, but mine was, they kept telling us, said, well, you get through jump school now, and you said you got a 20-day furlough coming, you go home and stuff like that. Well, that didn't happen. I kind of looked forward to that. I wanted to go home and stuff like that. But going to jump school, in a way, you know, I saw that a movie I was talking about jumping. I think, well, that's the best way to get in there and fight. But they didn't tell me once you landed, you was right in the middle of them. It was all around you, you know. That kind of worked on me a little bit, you know.
Very much so. Were you with the initial, and we'll get into this later on too, but were you with the initial dropping into Germany?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All righty. Now, we're past basic training. You've done all your training. Unfortunately, you didn't get to go home for your 20 days.
No, I didn't.
Where did you go once you left Fort Benning?
They shipped me, when I left Fort Benning, they shipped me over to what they call the frying pan. That's just right across the river from Fort Benning there, mm-hmm. in Alabama. See? And was in there for probably 2 months. And then from there on, then they got orders for shipping out. See? And then from there, we got on a train and we headed to Camp... what was it? Shanks, New York. That's where we got. And everything was secret. When after we got to Camp Shanks, got off the train, before we got off the train, we was all dressed, we were paratroopers then. We had, you know, how we had the boots, mm-hmm. you know, we had to take them off and take straight pants and take all our signals off, our parachute and everything. They couldn't tell what was directly infantry or what we were.
Right.
And then from there we went on the ship and there was no indication that we were paratroopers all the way across to Europe. It was on from there, I think it was about 12 days or so from the left Camp Shanks base in port in New York and got to Casablanca.
Casablanca.
That's where we landed.
How long did you spend in Casablanca?
Oh, about 3 days or something like that. That was another weird situation. You never knew. I was amazed at those people over there.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And but first, as far as they had men and women, they used the same bathroom and all that stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And that kind of got me, made me a little nervous, you know. So I went in one of them, then there was a woman sitting right next to me, you know. Yeah. And the men, if they had just have to take a leak or something like that, they do it right out in the street.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, that was weird.
Yeah. Did you get along fairly well with people in Casablanca a little time you
well,
were there?
Well, a little bit, but I was kind of a guy that always tried to get in mischief and stuff like that. So when we left Casablanca, they put us on what they call a 840 train. You know, they hold 8 horses or else 40 men.
Mm.
See? I understand there's a one of them trains, cars, is supposed to be here in Montana, something, probably up at Hamlin or something. Every state in the United States got one of them cars, mm-hmm. after war. So there's probably one up there. They call them 840s. That's what we travel clear across Africa, clear to Iran.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, while we were traveling, then I was coming away, they didn't think too much of me. See, over there, them Arabs, they liked those. We had the mattress deals. They were about 4 foot wide and about 6 feet long. You know, mm-hmm. we put hay or straw in, and then we could sleep on them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they liked them. They wanted them things they could wear them. See, they cut a hole in the, they closed in, and then each corner they put it over, and they had them on just like a big dress. They wear them around. And boy, they loved them. And I had them, and I traded it off 3 times while I was going across Africa.
3 times?
Yeah, I folded it all up, and then I tucked my jump rope on it, and then I anchored it in the car there in the car. And I deal with them guys. Well, they traded for melons and fruit and stuff like mm-hmm. that, you know. And then just about the time the train started moving, you know, then I handed it to them, and the train took off, and then he got to the end of that, he jerked it out of his hand, and I pulled it back in, and boy, did call you every day on his son. I don't know what they were saying, but...
That's great.
And I've done it 3 times. I guess it was kind of an honorary thing to do, but...
That's awesome.
I love that fruit and stuff, and I always take off. It got me in trouble a few times, but we'll go into that when we hit Sicily.
Do you remember arriving at Casablanca? Like, did you...
Oh, yeah.
What was it like? I mean, as far as pulling up for the first time?
Well, all the Arab kids, mostly all around there, you know, I guess they got accustomed because when they made the invasion in there, they got accustomed to the American soldiers. And then when we come, and they done free hand stuff, you know, they beg you for this and beg you for that and different stuff like that, you know. Cigarettes and candy.
Cigarettes and candy. Yeah. Now, you said you were only in Casablanca for 3 days.
Yeah.
And what did you do during that time?
Well, most of the thing, they kept us in the camp and got us ready and interrogated us, got us ready for what's going to happen and all this and stuff. And this. But they didn't tell us when it was going to invasion were, you know, but they didn't tell us that.
Right. Yeah. Now, you're past Casablanca.
Yeah.
You're moving into...
Right across, I can't remember all the country, but from Casablanca, went clear over there, next to the, what they call that, part of the Mediterranean Sea there, I guess we're on Sicily there.
Right.
Yeah. Iran, right next to, they called it Iran then. I guess it's changed names since the war, you know, so. And that's where we set up camp and we got ready. And then we went in to Minnesota. We stayed there for about a month. And nothing but just training. They take us out to the desert. And then they jumped us out in the desert. And then we walk off with three different guys. And you had to walk your way back and use a compass and a green sheet to find your way back to camp, you know. Well, I jumped with two Indians. They were out of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And their name was Brown Brothers, what they were. So, they gave me the compass and the green sheet. And so when we jumped, we got ready then. I laid my paper out and I get my grid sheet. And they told me what degrees off in north, you know, that we find a camp. I was looking at that, and the senior walked up to me and he said, "What are you doing, Ruben?" I said, "Getting ourselves lined up well ahead." And he says, "Oh, forget about that." He says, "You see that star? It was a night, and that was midnight when they jumped us." He said, "You see that star up there?" He said, "We'll follow it." Taking 2 days, 2.5 days, we're back in camp.
Oh, goodness.
Beat everybody else. Yeah. In the daytime, we'd sleep where we find one of them little oases, you know, there's a water hole, some trees, we stand there. Of course, we had to watch lions and tigers and stuff like that, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had to shoot one of them hyenas, though, the son of a gun. He tried to take us, you know. And I figured, well, either him or me.
About the lions and tigers and the hyena and everything. How did that, I mean...
Well, that when I was a kid, I saw movies and stuff like that. They could eat you, you know.
Exactly.
That's what bothered me, you know. That's why I didn't take a chance.
It's not a deer or an elk.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, after you've done all this training in Iran, I'm assuming on the coast there.
Yeah.
You said you were there about a month. I'm assuming that from there you went into Germany?
That's when we made the invasion in Sicily.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Okay. Well, after we got through all that training and stuff, they really pushed us. I mean, we trained maybe 12 hours a day, you know, then slept a little bit, and then they'd wake us up and we'd go train some more. It was a continuous training, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was first for combat. Well, it was as much for the officers and everything. And our regimental commander was Colonel Gavin. I imagine you've probably heard about Gavin. Did you hear anything about paratroopers? You heard about General Gavin?
Okay.
Well, he was our regimental commander. And he wanted to make sure, when he flew over to Sicily a couple of days before the invasion with a plane, and they took pictures and stuff like that, he wanted to make sure what was going on and everything. So, but anyway, we got ready. So at midnight, just before midnight, we got in this plane. So we jumped. When we landed in Sicily, it's just about 4 or 5 minutes after midnight. That is. And our jump area, they had them all this year. We were supposed to jump fairly close to Clarino in Sicily. See? That was up in the northwestern part of the island, you know. Well, our plane, when we went across there, and in the plane, we entered this a stick paratrooper, 16 men and stick, and they got a cable running in the center of the plane,
mm-hmm.
and there's this ripcord on the back of our parachute that snaps up into that cable, see, so we didn't have to pull anything, we had to jump off, okay. And we flying along, and pretty soon the pilot, he turned a green light on, see. Well, first he turned a red light on, that to warn us that was getting close to jump, see.
Right.
So we all stood up there and got all hooked up, you know, and the first guy would snap on, and there'd be a jump master at the door, and the one in the back, way in the end of the group, and he checked the first guy, see. And when we jumped in there, and I was about the fourth or fifth guy, see, and you're all hooked up, and the guy, you snap it in, and then the guy behind you, he checked your back, and he set the snap, and then he'd tap you on the shoulder and tell you when I'm back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave us, they wanted us to jump 16 guys, and it says about 18 seconds, they wanted all of us out of that airplane. See, the faster we jumped, the less distance we'd have in between them.
Right.
Well, anyway, we got that, and the light come on for green, we jumped, and the captain looked out of the door, and he looked, all he could see is water, so he turned around, and he said, the pilot, he says, we're not jumping, he says, there's water down below. The guy, he flew clear across the island before he put that light on. So he turned around, and he come back, you know. So when the light on, then we looked down, well, there's ground down, then the light come back on, so we jumped. Well, when they hit the ground, I didn't know where in the heck I was at. Running around. I finally got there, ended up, there was 10 of us. Well, there was somebody out of the H Company, and there's two guys out of a D Company, and I was the only one out of G Company. We got in a group there, and we was by ourselves, just the 10 of us. We were just fighting in there. We didn't know where the heck. We found out later we were 10 miles from where we were supposed to be.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we fought there from different places and got in different battles and stuff like that. We tried to avoid the big battles, you know, if we could get by them, but heck, you don't know where in the heck you're going or what you're doing and stuff like that. So we wanted to, so we run across this German tank, and it was out there, and I told them, guys, I said, that thing could give us trouble. I says, I'll try to knock it off, you know. And I was a bazooka gunner then. I had my bazooka when I landed, and I had that, because I had maybe 8 rounds, and that's what I jumped with.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the supplies, I don't know where that was. That was someplace in Sicily, I don't know.
10 miles away.
Yeah. But, so we, well, first of all, there was a corporal in the bunch, and I told him, I said, you're the ranking, I was a VFC at the end, and I said, yeah, you're the one who's going to have to make the arrangements and judgment what we're going to do in the plan. I said, you're the corporal. And he looked at me and says, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. So they got together and said, okay, they pointed me to be the leader. See. And I figured, boy, you guys are in trouble. You expect me to be
the leader. The blind leading the blind.
We were in 3 battles. We come out all right on it. We done pretty good, but we had to be careful. The only ammunition and supplies we had is what we carried on with us, what we jumped with. So every time we're in a battle or something like that, we'd go through, well, if we killed 15, 20 guys, the Germans or something like that, we'd go through, we'd pick up all the weapons and ammunition they had, see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even some of the food, you know, heck, what food, we only had enough food for 2 days, and that's them little potted meat and eggs and stuff like that, and what they call a hard tack, is a cracker about that big around, because you had to soak it for 5 minutes before you could eat it. So we even took their food and stuff like that, and we kept going. And we was going like that for about 8 days before we run into somebody else. But up until that time, we were coming in this tank, this German tank, and I don't know what to say to it, but I shot at it 3 times with a bazooka. But they spotted me. See, that bazooka, when it fires, that shell, fire shoots out the back about 4 or 5 feet, and they can spot that stuff real quick. See. So they started shooting at me from that tank. See. So I got in a grape battle, a wine vineyard, it's a grape vineyard and stuff there, and I bet you I crawled 20 miles in that thing back and forth trying to keep away from them guys. And I finally got within 40 feet of that tank. So I fixed one of what they call a gamma grenade, we call it, and composition C is the same as that C4 they call it now. We called it composition C then. I imagine it's a little different kind of explosive too. So I moved, and I carried what we call a Gammon grenade. It's a knit a sack, and it had a detonator up on top with a cover on it, you know. Mm-hmm. And you take the cover off, there's a string band run around there with a little lead weight on it. When that unwinds, and then it will explode when it hits. That thing. So I took that and I shot 2 pounds of that composition C and that thing. And I threw it. I was about 40 feet away from when I threw it. While I was in there, he was pointing off in the direction where I was before, and he's still trying to shoot over that direction. So, and it knocked the right track, part of the front track, right off the on the tank. Mm-hmm. You know. And then he said, when he tried to move his darn thing, he just buried himself in the stuff. That's as far as the wind. I took off. So we got back with a group, and I told them, I left my bazooka lay back there. So I grabbed them and the guys, and I had 3 shells left. Mm-hmm. In that time. So we took off, and we ran into another little